One of my issues that I've been concentrating on for a long time, and I'd mentioned it before the panel began, in which Peter really addressed very well just now, but looking at the relationship between human legislation and natural law. And all too frequently, it would seem that human legislation is in violation of natural law. I would like to ask the panelists to think about that. And does anybody have anything they want to say about that at this moment in time? I noticed that one thing that Em alluded to earlier on was that maybe some of those early folks would roll over in their graves if they thought that human use actually had to be shared beyond just the human organism. For example, my friend Bill DeBuise, a friend of many of us here, mentioned to me many years ago that at the beginning of the 20th century, so much of water law was based on the gospel of efficiency. Basically, we were looking at things solely from the point of human use. And as Peter brought out, we have to think in terms of the ecosystem itself, the whole biotic community, because we're part of that. And so is there any chance that law in New Mexico, if indeed New Mexico has this star reputation for being the furthest out of the states with regard to law, water legislation, how can we make that even to a bigger concept to include the ecosystem itself? Is this beyond law?
I mean, I think we're on the way to that a little bit. I mean, we're recognizing in-stream flow rights by any other name is simply a right that belongs to the river itself. I mean, there had been a famous law review article 20, 30 years ago about should trees have standing? That is, should they be able to raise legal objections of their own to the way they were treated in the way that natural resources should be able to speak for themselves, well, not for themselves, but that they should have an independent status in that system. And I think that we're moving in that direction because we have to. Because we'll pay a huge price if we don't. And the whole thing will collapse because it really does depend on a genuine respect for how resources actually operate. So if that's what natural law is, that's a good thing.
Yeah, and I guess natural law, to a certain extent, we might know what that is. When we get into the details, there might be quite a bit of disagreement over what natural law actually means. If you ask, I actually was going to make an example, but I don't think I will because it involves religion. I think the law is adaptable, and I think an example is the Endangered Species Act, which is going to force flows to protect the minnow. Unfortunately, there's a lot of due process that you have to go through to make that law effective, and there's decades of litigation. But I also think the prior appropriation is adaptable. 20 years ago or so, Letty Beelin with the Attorney General's office wrote an opinion that just stated very clearly why you don't need a diversion to have a water right in the prior appropriation system. And then just recently, the Court of Appeals came out with a decision called the Colangelo decision saying you don't need to consumptively use water to have a water right. And with those, you put those two together and, you know, you've got in-stream flows or environmental flows or whatever you want to call them today. The problem is the way that's going to work is that there's going to be organizations like the Audubon Society or others that have to buy up rights and then transfer those into the stream to make it work. It's not going to happen on its own. It takes money, of course, and it takes working with these bureaucracies to make it happen.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to bring up, isn't it? Could we construe contemporary culture as being economically rather than ecologically driven?
Used to be. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the way prior appropriation worked. It was an economic doctrine. You took the water and you made it do something that it wouldn't do naturally in order to produce something that nature wouldn't produce on its own. It, there's a big strain of prior appropriation law that's full of that, and it's anti-natural by definition.
And I wanted to, the positive part of the prior appropriation system, it developed in the 19th century, and the idea was, it was, and you hear commentators and courts, contemporary, during that time, calling the aim of the doctrine as to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And that's what the way it did that is it required, you couldn't establish a right unless you actually use the water, and then you could only have a right up to your actual use, and if you failed to use it, then it went to somebody else. And you know, on the negative side, that was part of manifest destiny. It was to settle the West. But the idea was to spread out the water to as many people as possible. You've got to take that concept and now broaden it to include the natural world. And we're, of course, part of the net. We are the natural world.
Absolutely, because we are a species of trillions of species that have lived. We're all descended from the same last universal common ancestor of about 3.5 billion years ago. And so if we looked at it like that, we're akin to the gnats that bite us on the legs when we go out and work in the garden. But it seems to me, well, for example, there's a wonderful book. Well, it's pretty academic, and it's a little tough going, but a woman, I mentioned her just before our panel discussion this evening, a woman by the name of Eleanor Ostrom, who got the 2009 Nobel Prize for Economics with her book, Governing the Commons. And her concept, along with that of her husband, was that governance for water rights should be based on what they called the polycentric system, whereby there was a state of reciprocity between the grassroots, say, with the Zia Pueblo, working through various levels, say through state government, all the way up to the federal level, but that the grassroots level should have a really powerful voice in all of this, and that should have been based largely on the notion of sharing right down the line. You share the good years, but you also share the bad years, and that is not something that seems to really appear to me in current law. And the question is, and I'm sure that everybody here in this room needs to understand, if we have a way of getting to some sort of a more realistic approach, the whole concept of manifest destiny, which was invented back in 1836 and basically claimed a God-given right for the people east of the 100th meridian to take over west of the 100th meridian, regardless of the people who lived here. We're still living with that. One of the things that really has impressed me forevermore, this map shows John Wesley Powell's idea of having settled the West watershed by watershed. Now, that's something that can't be done anymore. A big consideration here, and I've brought this out with every panel, that I've been, in my lifetime, the human population of the planet has more than tripled. And yet we have the finite resource of water here in the arid Southwest. This is a big factor. How do we begin to square these things? In other words, is there some sort of an imperative that can be evoked in order to straighten out thinking in the state legislature or in the minds of the economists, or is there not? Or do we have to become anarchists?
This is being recorded, right? I can't quite advocate revolution right now. I think I think it's a lot of procedure and years of litigation to make changes that are necessary to make the system work for everybody and for everything. And unfortunately, with climate change, there's less and less water. We can just write the hell out of laws, but we can't make any more water, and it's getting more and more scarce. And I don't think the legislature is going to make it easy.
Yeah, I understand. One of the things is that we're driven by our mores, and that's a tough bias to get through. I've been presented a few notions from the audience, and we have very little time, so we won't be able to address all of them, but here's one right on top, and I'll read this. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but if anybody has any insights into this one. The U.S. federal government joined Texas in suing New Mexico for violating compact. How will this affect future water allocation?
It's got to do with the Rio Grande Compact. New Mexico had always claimed that the state boundary is really at Elephant Butte Dam. And what New Mexico's obligation under the compact was to deliver water to Elephant Butte. And Texas is getting less and less water out of Elephant Butte because New Mexico intentionally has developed more and more groundwater resources there that take the releases from Elephant Butte that would otherwise get to Texas and take them through the groundwater. And that's what's going on in that suit. I happen to know New Mexico knew that this was going to happen, and it's probably known for 20 or 30 years. So the chickens are coming home to roost, and we'll see what happens. But that's what's going on with respect to that. As I say, the compact set New Mexico's obligation at Elephant Butte, and what happened between Elephant Butte and the Texas state land was anybody's game. Which is why Steve Reynolds never took control of the groundwater below the Elephant Butte Dam as he did above the Elephant Butte Dam. He just let anybody take whatever they wanted to because he knew that that would be Texas water.
I want to bring out something that here's a book M. Hall had a heap to do with the writing of, and it's called Reining in the Rio Grande, but that's R-E-I-N, not R-A-I-N. So, good book.
Yeah, well.
I finally got my very own copy, and I can return my borrowed one. Okay, here's another question from somebody. I have heard that some farmers in southern New Mexico don't have enough water to farm and therefore are selling their water rights to private companies. Is this true? And if so, is it legal?
Yes and yes.
Wow. Thank you.
That's because New Mexico has always said that water rights are property rights. And Reynolds, despite what Peter says, that they have marketability just like you. Reynolds used to say this, you can sell your home, you can sell your water rights, it's all the same thing.
Except that there's a difference between something that's been humanly constructed and something that exists as a common pool resource.
Well, I meant to put, because the basic, it's important to say this, because the real reason for prior appropriation in the old conception of things, and it comes out of the California gold fields, was that if you wanted to use water, you had to invest money in order to develop the resource, because it wasn't a resource in place. It had to be moved to another place in order to make its activity valid. That was for washing gold, for irrigating alfalfa fields. It required an investment. And unless you protected that investment, nobody could take the risk of developing the resource. It's an economic doctrine at bottom, and it's a way of protecting resources necessary in the view of these people to develop the resource and take the water from where it naturally occurs and apply it to beneficial use someplace else. And that's why they protected it as a property right.
So
it's changed a lot, but that's it. The bottom line, that's where it all started, and we're still working around the edges of that.
So, and I want to, my answer is no, yes and yes, that their water, farmers sometimes don't have enough water, and that they are, that they can sell off their water rights, sell, and when you say sell, you mean sever them from the irrigated property and move them someplace else. That's very possible, it happens all the time, but you can't do it unless you go through a pretty detailed state engineer process. There has to be notice. People get a chance to protest if it's going to impair their water rights or if they think it's contrary to conservation of water or if it's detrimental to public welfare. Those last two things don't have any concrete meaning, and the state engineer generally ignores them, but they're written into the law. So it's not an automatic that if you just get up and want to sell your water right, that you're actually going to be able to do it, or it's going to be easy or fun, or that you'll make any money. And if you haven't historically used all the water you're entitled to on paper, you can only transfer what you actually can show you used. And it's going to be limited by the historical supply and then further limited if you weren't using it, if you didn't use your full allocation. So it's not...
intricate and
it's
expansive.
Extremely intricate, yeah.
One of the things that M brought out to me a couple of years ago.
No, but
we were talking about the San Juan Chamada version, which is where 110,000 acre feet, 110,000 acre feet a year are being moved from east or west of the Continental Divide to east of the Continental Divide. And Albuquerque relies on that 110,000 acre feet for close to 50,000 acre feet. And Santa Fe relies on it for about 5,000 acre feet. And I wonder if you could talk about how that pits us against the other side of the Continental Divide.
There's a big debate about how secure those rights are to the upper basin allocation under the compact that divided the water between the upper basin states and the lower basin states. How secure the amount of water is that comes through from the Colorado side to the New Mexico side. And there's a debate about that. The state engineer's office has done long studies and said there's no problem. Everybody else looks at it and said, looks like trouble to me. You know, and other people, including myself, said, why would you do that? Why would Albuquerque essentially connect itself to Las Vegas, Phoenix, Los Angeles, and Tucson in the competition for water? You know you're not going to come out well in that battle, you know, because you're dealing with the heavyweights over on the Colorado River. But that reliance on the San Juan Chama water and the so-called sustainability of its supply, we're talking about whether it's as guaranteed or not, essentially changed Albuquerque's status with respect to water, because before that it was mining groundwater, whether it was Lake Erie or whether it wasn't Lake Erie, it was mining groundwater. And what that means is you're taking out more than goes in, and you're gonna mine it to exhaustion. That's the mining law term, and it's terrifying with respect to aquifers, but it's guaranteed to happen in time if that's what the situation is. And they're still mining the aquifer in Albuquerque, even with the addition of the sustainable San Juan Chama water. That water is going to be gone. 2060 is what they think now. there's going to be another real shortage. And as with the engineers, they're saying something will happen. Phoenix, pumping water out of Mexico, exchanging it for Colorado River, all kinds of weird deals going on. Las Vegas is in real trouble because it got such a small allocation of lower Colorado River water rights and is in desperate shape to try to support its growth by finding additional water supplies, mostly going to groundwater, which will be mined,
out of the Great Basin Desert.
Yeah.
And boy, the ranchers, I've worked with those ranchers.
Some people say, and I understand this completely, is you should never build cities on water supplies that you can't guarantee will be there forever, that is sustainable water supplies. We're not doing that with municipal supplies, even with these changes in,
Well, one of the
things. And then you're looking at Chaco, way down the pipe. They're going to run out of water.
Yes, absolutely. Well, growth is happening. I mean, the cities of the American Southwest are growing as rapidly as any cities in the United States. And here we are with ever more limited water supplies. And so we can anticipate hard times coming down the pike. And it was like Peter was saying earlier on, thinking in terms of seven generations, three generations in the past, our current generation, and three generations in the future. Boy, we have, what we do right now is going to have an enormous effect on our kids and our grandkids and their kids.
The perpetuity definition in water law traditionally has come from the length of a mortgage that it took to capitalize the money to develop the water resource. 30 years.
And so there's a vast difference between 30 years and seven generations.
There is.
And so therein lies the conflicting absolutes. We've run out of time. But I really want to thank everybody for coming to this panel. I'm hoping that some of the stuff that we got expressed out here this evening might have taken root. One thing that I would advocate is that we all have to get involved in this. I really do believe in the grassroots. I have infinitely more faith personally in the grassroots than I do from powers on high. And I think that there's a lot of intelligence in the grassroots, and if we do work together and take a big cue from our Native American friends who understand the concept of sharing rather than turning it into money, we might get somewhere. So thank you so much for coming. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.